Hello, folks, and welcome back to the High Performance Human Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Ward, and it is my goal to help you upgrade your human performance by guiding you towards improved sleep, nutrition, fitness, mobility, and stress management. Work on just one of those, and you'll be on the pathway to living longer, living healthier, and of course, improving your athletic performance. If you're interested in joining me on this journey, please check out my SWAT Inner Circle, where you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Just email Beth at thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes. Now, on today's show, I'm joined by a man who helps people to run faster. Which we all want, right? And yet, he doesn't call himself a running coach. He calls himself a movement coach. Shane Benzi has a coaching philosophy which leads him to take an anthropological view of a runner. Shane believes that if we move like a human is designed to move, that will make us a better athlete. To maximise our potential, we must take that human movement and turn it into human performance. His coaching is designed to create an intelligent runner that has the correct perception of their movement, and it encourages them to see changes in gait as a software change rather than teaching the physical body new tricks. This is a great conversation because it looks at running improvement from a completely different perspective. And like most of the conversations, we cover a diverse range of topics, including how everyday movement patterns influence your running style, the benefits of using a stand-up desk, counting strides and why it leads to imbalance in run technique, the role of the fascia, Shane's tensegrity model, and the sea of tension, understanding what good movement looks like and feels like, the optimal running cadence, foot strike and the tripod landing, running drills and why they're not necessarily a good thing, and finally, Shane provides his four tips for better running. So, without further ado, let's crack on with today's guest. Welcome to the show, Shane Benzi.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm great, thank you, Shane. Brilliant that you could join me today. I'm really keen to understand more about running and how we can run better, because I'm one of those people who wants to run better.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think we all do.
Certainly, if you're a triathlete, I think that's one of the biggest things that I hear people say is how can I run faster? But it's not quite as simple as that, is it? It's not complicated, but it is complex.
Yeah, some of the fundamentals are actually dangerously simple. And I guess it's about taking human movement, learning to move like a human, but then kind of turning that into human performance. So There are some bits that are fundamentally very simple, and they have these amazing light bulb moments happen as people are learning. But you're also always looking at marginal gains and how we can kind of almost iron out the idiosyncrasies of the human body to create human performance. So the game's always changing. So there's subtle stuff and there's relatively simple stuff.
It's amazing how many of the experts I have chatting on this say, it's actually fairly simple, Simon. There's just a few fundamentals that we need to get right. But of course, everybody wants to, like, I know what I need to run faster. I need to get some Nike Vaporflies. I know what I need to do. I need to take beetroot juice before I go to the track, or I need to do a weekly track session. Like, just do some simple things will make a difference.
Yeah, I think we all love to try and buy our way out of trouble, don't we? I think it's probably easier to order something that will turn up in 2 days' time in a box that we can open and then transform, rather than maybe putting some weeks or months into kind of changing something more holistically. But if you can give it the time, and actually once you start to think about things and start treating them as a skill, they become far more interesting anyway. So we shouldn't just try and buy our way out of trouble.
I can remember being sucked into that particular sort of buy yourself some speed when I was about 15 or 16. I used to go running with some mates around the fields in the little village I lived in. One of my friends came back and he said, I've seen these running shoes, you know, they look fabulous. And so I managed to get to a pure running shop, you know. It was all sort of singlets and spikes and things. And, you know, the only people that went in there were scrawny, lean blokes with long hair and tatties. And they were... they were Onitsuka Tigers, these shoes. So I'm going back a bit now. And they were sort of like almost like a fluorescent blue with orange streaks on the side. And they were so light. And I bought a pair. And Kenny, my friend who I ran with, said, "Oh, they look great, Si, can you get me some?"
And we were convinced that this was taking time off our runs, you know, until I think one of Kenny got a stress fracture in his foot from standing on a stone because the shoes were so thin, you know, there was no protection when we were running across country. And so that was the end of that little escapade. But they did make you feel $1 million for the first few runs.
Listen, absolutely. And perception is very, very important. We just need to feel $1 million about ourselves rather than we bought. And I had a similar thing. I mean, when I first got into my journey, I remember, you know, I was getting injured a lot. I was kind of suffering from, I had two big challenges like most runners, I think, certainly in my experience over the last decade of working with runners. And those two big challenges were I was getting injured a lot and I just wasn't getting any better. And, you know, just always struggling and sort of going from one injury to another. And I remember paying £25 for a pair of socks. This was 10 years ago, so that was quite a lot of money 10 years ago, that had this silver lining in them that was going to make me more bouncy. And so, you know, I bought these socks, and as I bought them, I thought, do you know what? Something's got to give here, because sure enough, they didn't stop my left knee really hurting, and you know, they were soon gone. And that was probably one of the big things that started to make me think, actually, I need to take ownership of this and start to move better, because bouncy socks just aren't doing it for me. So similar thing.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Is that you sort of said you started this journey because you were injured and you wanted to get faster. And again, going back to a lot of the guests I've had on here, it's amazing how their journeys have started with trying to solve a particular problem. So I had a gynecologist, female gynecologist on recently, who was 100 pounds overweight, and she just felt ill. She had no energy. She couldn't work. She couldn't get out of bed, and she needed to heal herself. And since sort of turning towards functional medicine rather than standard westernized medicine, she's moved on from being a gynecologist and studied Eastern medicine and has become a functional medicine practitioner. Now she helps other females. So solving her problem has now allowed her to move into a new realm to help her solve other people's problems. And, you know, that seems to be quite common.
Absolutely. And I think if you get, you know, I got passionate about my own journey and saw what a difference it made for me. And then you want to start sharing that, because, you know, you ride on the back of that passion. You know, you're constantly got excitement, flooding back over you, because you create that in the people that you work with. And that's really good. You know, it's nice to be surrounded by such positivity, to be honest.
Yeah, well, authenticity and integrity are two of the key things in building a solid platform for your business, aren't they? So, well, now we're talking about your journey. So, what were you doing before? You're obviously a recreational runner. You were getting injured. You wanted to get faster. So what were you doing for a living at that point?
I was working. I did a lot of work with sharks. So I spent a lot of time working with sharks and spent a lot of time in the water with them, studying them, tagging them, and kind of understanding their movements, and actually kind of working to get sort of better sort of government legislation to protect them and stuff like that. So that's kind of what I was doing. I also had a business which had nothing to do with running or anything. As soon as I kind of got into the running thing decided that I, you know, got really interested in it and started to want to be a coach, I sold the business. Decided that running was what I wanted to do. But I'd always, because I'd studied sharks and because I'd worked a lot with sharks, I kind of was really keen to study runners as humans, as part of the human species. You know, sharks have been around for 400 million years, so they're pretty good at what they do, which is swimming around, eating and having baby sharks. Not too much has changed for them in the last 400 million years, whereas actually for humans, we've been around for next to no time and have gone through some huge changes. Mm. Even in the last 15,000 years, you know, 15,000 years ago, we would have been hunter-gatherers. Then we went to being farmers. Yeah. Then the Industrial Revolution came along, and now the Technological Revolution. So in the blink of an eyelid, how we move or don't move has changed hugely, and yet our body really hasn't. So we're really like a fish out of water at the moment, or a shark out of water, if you like. So that was fascinating. That was what I was doing before I got into studying humans and running.
Well, that sounds like it could be a whole different podcast, because I do some diving, and of course, and I do some open water swimming and some paddleboarding. And of course, when you're out there in the big wide ocean, the thing that's most on your mind is, what will I do if I see a fin?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about sharks is, you know, they're really not that, you know, there's no calorific value in a human to a shark. They're really not interested in us. They, you know, they're really not, they're really not, we're not part of their food chain. You know, on occasion, humans do come into contact with sharks, but it's you know, from the shark's point of view, it's pretty much mistaken identity generally. Yeah. They're really geared up to, and I spent time in the water with great whites, with tiger sharks, bull sharks, and they you know, providing there's kind of good visibility, they're really, and they know who you are, they're really not that interested.
Yeah,
at all. So we shouldn't be scared of them. They're amazing creatures. We should get excited about them because you know, their numbers are dropping at a great rate of knots, and so we should not sort of, you know, we shouldn't demonize them so much and actually get excited about them because they're fascinating creatures.
Well, we should perhaps get back to running. So
probably
we should. So you decided you wanted to be a running coach, and then what? I mean, you've written this book. I mean, you said, if you could remind me what the book is, Lost Art of Running, I think it is. So did the coaching come first and then you decided you were going to write a book, or did you decide to go on a journey to find out about, you know, some of the tribes and the best ways to run, write the book, and then the coaching followed on from that?
No, the book is basically the story about 10 years of traveling around the world and doing my research and coaching and trying to understand what human movement is. So I was pretty fit as a runner and I had a lot of good kit. So I kind of narrowed it down to the fact that I just wasn't running very well. I wasn't moving very well. So that was what I kind of endeavored to try and change. And I got into it. It was all very confusing. Everything seemed to be done on a treadmill, and biomechanics was the word that kept sort of coming back at me. And it kind of all confused me a little bit. But I thought, actually, the best way to learn to run is to become a coach. So I went out to America and qualified as the coach, and came back and started coaching. And that was good fun. I was enjoying the coaching. But it seemed pretty limited to me, or my ability or my knowledge seemed pretty limited, because most of the coaching seemed to be around not getting injured, but not really dynamic movement. And as it happened, by trying to avoid injury, we move in a way where we're more likely to get injured because we just don't anticipate impact and use impact. So that confused me a bit, and I remember once a runner coming to me, a good runner, and kind of said, you know, they moved really well, but they just kind of said, I want to go faster. How do I go faster? And I thought, you know, I'm kind of curious about that myself, because all of the coaching and all of what I've learned was about getting people moving in what we thought was an efficient way, but not dynamically. So I kind of downed tools and just thought, right, I love this. I'm really interested in it, but I need to know more. How can I learn more? None of the courses made sense to me. So I thought, I'm just going to go and live with the best runners in the world. I'm just going to go and find the best runners in the world, and I'm going to hang out with them and have a good look and see what they do. It seemed like the thing to do. So, and I kind of identified East Africa as a, you know, it was then and still is a hotbed for running. The Ethiopian, the Kenyans and the Ugandans now move amazingly well. You know, I was watching them on TV. They weren't moving in any way that I was seeing in the Western world. And certainly I wasn't coaching people to move like that. So I went out to Ethiopia. That was my first trip. And I'd heard about this amazing coach who was up in the Rift Valley, working in a very small town, but had brought through amazing runners from youngsters like Tirunesh Dibaba and Bekele, a whole list of amazing runners. This guy had kind of picked up as youngsters and had sort of brought them through and had done this many, many, many times. So I went off to find him, and I did. I found him, and I managed to spend about a month out there. He was very kind, very giving with his time, and sort of let me kind of shadow him and watch him and ask him questions and discuss stuff and speak to the athletes and stuff like that. So I was out there about a month. But what I was seeing, I didn't really know what it was at the time, but what I was seeing was this movement that was very kind of synergistic and connected and fluid. Elastic is the word that I kind of came home with. You know, I'm seeing elastic movement here. I don't know what it is. Why are they elastic and why am I not? Because we've all essentially got the same bits. And so when I got back, I kind of then put my research hat on and thought, right, okay, why is that? Why is that? And I probably Googled something like Elastic Runner or something like that, and started to then understand what it was I was seeing. And I very quickly found fascia, and I very quickly found the concept of tensegrity. And they immediately, I'm thinking, yeah, this is what I just saw. This is what I just saw. So I went on some courses and looked at that kind of stuff and started to learn more about it.
Fascia is really interesting. There was a book written by Chris McDougall a few years ago. He was the guy who wrote Born to Run. So again,
Natural Born Heroes, I think he mentioned.
Natural Born Heroes, yes. And yeah, that talks about the Cretans from the island of Crete who used to run and bound across the rocks. And he was, you know, how did they do that? And it's about using the stored elasticity, using the movement properly to be able to find spring to move from one position to another at the side of the hills that they were. I think it was to do with something about the resistance in the Second World War, wasn't it? And how they were able to move across the hills so efficiently.
Yeah, I think the book was more about the World War II and the resistance, but there was a little bit in there talking about how they were jumping on the rocks. So it didn't delve too much into what fascia was, but it talked about this elastic ability. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. And I was well into my research by then. So when I saw that, I thought, yeah, no, I absolutely get that.
Well, another interesting connection is that I had Kelly Starrett, Dr. Kelly Starrett, the sort of the man who is a bit of a legend within the CrossFit circles. He's called K-Star. And he's written a book called How to Be a Supple Leopard. So you've probably seen that one.
I've got it.
Big on fascia, and he knows Chris McDougall. And so we sort of got, you know, a bit of a circle being completed here. And this whole thing about fascia starts to crop up a bit more. My physio, Louisa, is really into the idea of fascia and myofascial release and all of that sort of thing, and how the whole body is connected. And, you know, you've got a problem with your foot, but it may be because your fascia's tight around your left ear because you've twisted your neck and you've lifted something, or you've been walking around with your phone to your ear by your shoulder.
Yeah.
But I still think that most people haven't heard of it. So maybe you can talk about fascia a little bit, explain what it is, and you've got this thing called tensile integrity, or tensegrity, you call it. So, and I know you're going to show us a little model with your little...
I'm never more than about a metre away from my tensegrity model, because to me it explains everything.
So you give us the elevator pitch. It's a big building, so you've got more than 30 seconds to tell us about fascia and give us the tensegrity model, and then we'll make sure that part of the video is on YouTube for people to link to.
Okay. Yeah. So the concept of tensegrity is that essentially all the bones in your body are floating in an elastic sea of tension. Mm-hmm. Okay. 206 bones, and they just float. We tend to think of our skeleton. I think this is where we move differently from people that I study all around the world, is that we tend to move thinking that our skeleton is actually the main structure of the body. Yeah. Because whenever we see a skeleton, it is kind of stood upright in front of us. It's always grinning. Yeah, it's always grinning. And it just looks like it's supporting itself. And that could be the Natural History Museum. You go in, there's full of glass cases of skeletons. They've all just stood there looking at you. Looks like they could just run off if they wanted to. You know, 6-year-old's biology book, A-level biology book, it's all skeletons stood there just looking at you. The cartoons, everything we see is that way. So I think we could be forgiven for thinking that, you know, when we move around, our skeleton is the structure and everything else is just kind of hanging off of that. But that's not what I see. It's what I thought, because, of course, I've grown up with that thought process. But when I started to travel and when I started to see different people moving, and actually a lot of my research is also based on perception of movement. So even the tribes and indigenous people that I go and live with and study don't run, because that would be wasting energy. There's no need. You don't run if you don't have to, if you're looking to save energy, because you've got to find your own food. The last thing you do is run for fun. Mm-hmm. They're good at it. They just don't do it. But if you talk to them about their perception of movement, they have their relationship with the skeleton is absolutely completely different to ours. So here is my tensegrity model. So this kind of explains it to me. So hopefully that will mean something to your listeners and viewers for this. So it's a child's toy, but actually it tells a really interesting story about our relationship with our skeleton and our fascial system, our elastic system. So the fascial system is essentially tendons, ligaments, and myofascia. Okay. So this children's toy, this tensegrity model, basically shows us that if the wooden dowels are your bones and the elastic stuff that kind of holds this toy together is your fascial system, it shows us that actually when you move, no bone in your body touches another bone. This model has really good integrity and tension in it. It supports itself, but it isn't the bones or the wooden parts of it that are creating that, you know, that are creating that. It's the elasticity around them. But I guess actually there's a very symbiotic relationship between bone, muscle, and fascia. They all need each other. Mm-hmm. So when you're running, moving, or doing anything, if you get beautiful height into your body, you load this elastic system, you load tension into your elastic system, and then any movement that you make has elastic recoil on it. If you were to run around with your head down, you've now pulled the teeth on your elastic system. There really isn't any elastic energy in your body at all. Get tall and you load it. So when you move, when you run, when you hit a ball, when you dance, when you swim, when you do anything, your skeleton is just free flowing in a sea of elasticity. Every single bone in your body just sits in its own little elastic trampoline. And what's really exciting about this stuff is that this stuff that binds us together, creates the sea of tension, creates the elastic recoil, creates the elastic energy, it's never more than 7 months old. It's rejuvenating and re-architecting itself at a rate of knots based on how you broke it down. So if you start doing dynamic, stretchy, elastic things, then you start to develop a body that can do that. If you sit on the sofa and watch box sets, you'll have an elastic system that's amazing at that. So, you know, we're very much in control as to how dynamic our body is. And what's exciting about the fascia, the elastic recoil and the elastic energy it's created, it doesn't really want any oxygen or calories and doesn't produce lactate. So during the actual effort, it doesn't really want much from you. Whereas, of course, muscles are very greedy. They do. But because we grow up thinking that we are powered by muscles, that's the way we move.
Yeah. Now, I've read Natural Born Heroes. I've read, what was the first one he did? Born to Run. Sure. And I've seen some of the documentaries about the indigenous tribesmen in different parts of the world. I read another book where they did some running with the Navajo Indians. I spoke to an Indian gentleman who's Sanjay Rawal, who's based in America, about ultra running, and a documentary he did about the Sri Chinmoy race. But as part of that documentary, he spent some time running with the Navajo and the sort of the little running competitions that they have on their reservations. And of course, sure, the main central characters of the Born to Run book were the Tarahumara, who are based in Mexico. And the thing that strikes me about all of these indigenous tribes that you talk about is that most of them probably still have a life where they don't spend all day sat behind a desk looking at a computer or driving everywhere. I'm sure that Western habits are creeping in slowly, but they still are largely manual. They walk to places. They manually tend the fields to grow crops. They spend most of their day doing tasks that require them to be moving rather than sitting down. So their body's always moving. And so it doesn't get tight and it doesn't get kinked up. Whereas in the Western world, we've got into this sedentary life where we spend most of our day sitting down, and it's very hard to break out of that and sort of change to then become a better runner. So it almost seems like in order to become a better runner, it's all about human movement and movement practice rather than actually running more and running faster.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. I mean, I very quickly stopped being a running coach and became a movement coach even after my first trip to Ethiopia. Yeah, that's straight away. On the plane back, I was now in my mind a movement coach, not a running coach. I think there are two, there are many influences on our movement, but I think the two biggest are our perception of our movement So we've just been talking about that with regards to the tensegrity concept. If you understand that concept, if you buy into that concept and you change your perception of your sea of tension and the elastic ability of the body, you will move in a different way because you want to accentuate what you now know. So if we can see that if we run tall, we load our elastic system, then we will do that. So our perception of our movement is absolutely key. The other big influence on our movement is, as you rightly say, our everyday movement. If you go for a run, your body run with the sea of tension you've created in your everyday life. You don't spend time in your kitchen the way that you run. You run the way that you spend your time in your kitchen or at work or wherever you are. So it's a very, very important message to this. And sitting, obviously, we do a lot of it these days. You know, we do a lot of sitting. And we just look from that tensegrity model, but actually if you close it down, you know, you really are compromising the sea of tension in that. Now, you're right, indigenous people, tribes, they often don't sit. I mean, it's changing at a rate of knots now, but actually they don't sit as much as we do. But, you know, certainly in the book, in The Lost Art of Running, I talk a lot about the standing desk. So both you and I, we can see each other, we're talking, but we're both stood. Yeah, we're both stood.
Yes.
You know, I believe that is an incredible, you know, if you had to list the top 10 things that would make you a better runner, right up there is getting yourself a standing desk, if indeed you spend all day at a desk. So, you know, if you were stood with tripod feet, a lengthened spine, neutral pelvis with your core engaged, head up, eye line on your computer, breathing into the bottom third of your lungs, you're training for 9 hours. Because when you run, it's an extension of that. Whereas if you sit with your head down, weighing four times more than it should, and crumpled up and creating this awful sea of tension, that's what you've got to take into a run. So, you know, we can really take ownership of this. And I appreciate that not everybody can, because everybody has different circumstances. But certainly with more people working at home at the moment, and that may well continue ongoing for a lot of people, we are in control of our environment. And actually, I think more and more people are understanding this sitting thing. And so I would urge anybody listening to this that if you're even within your work environment, if you ask, you know, say, look, you know, I want to spend at least some of my time weight bearing. It's incredibly important.
Well, I mentioned Kelly Starrett. One of his books is called Deskbound, and he's written it with his wife about that whole stand up desk movement. I think they even started a charity to get stand up desks in schools.
Wow,
which is great. But I was just thinking before you made that point that here are you and I. I'm at my stand up desk. You're standing up there. I think probably the number of guests that I have that stand is probably 10%. And yet we're on a call for at least an hour, hour and a half. But you can, when you stand and you talk, I feel so much more energized. I feel able to express myself better than I do when I'm sat. And I know when I record the you know, the intro and the outro for this, I will do it standing up because it allows me to sort of, when I want to emphasize words, I feel like I can do it more enthusiastically when I'm standing. And again, you talk about breathing. Again, something Louisa is the White Witch is big on. Something which comes up time and again, and yet most people, you know, they talk about, oh, breathing exercises. We all know how to breathe. Well, actually, we breathe to stay alive, but we don't really breathe effectively because, to your point there about breathing into your stomach, which is where two thirds of your lung capacity is, most people breathe into their ribs. And I guess if you might even do this when you have some of your running clinics, you get people to breathe in and 90% of them will
put
the shoulders up. You can see it very, very clearly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting because we've just said that your running posture, your running sea of tension is only going to be an extension of your everyday sea of tension. Mm-hmm. I guess the lungs are similar in a way because, you know, when we're not cardiovascularly challenged, you could argue it doesn't really matter too much how we breathe because we're not struggling to get air in and get it around the body because it's being used. But when we're running, clearly we are cardiovascular challenged, so we do need to maximize our air intake. But if we spend most of our day just breathing from the chest, we can't, just because we put a nice pair of trainers on and a bouncy pair of socks doesn't mean that suddenly our lungs are going to start working in a way where we want them to. So while we are stood at our desk or in our everyday life, if we can start to belly breathe more, I think you're starting to create that, you know, that breathing process. And, you know, I see a lot of, certainly movement to me is a software thing. It's not really a hardware thing. It's not a physical thing. It's a software thing. And so the more we can rewrite, going out and changing your movement tomorrow is rewriting your software. The hardware, the physical bodies follows that. So the more we can be cognitive and think about things as well as changing them, it makes a huge difference.
Well, we've talked about movement and mobility quite a lot. So let me just ask you some questions about running, and then we can sort of get on to how we might start to move towards being able to run better, you know, preempting that with moving better. I think we've covered the question about why humans run poorly and why do we need corrective health. It's to do with, mostly to do with our habits, and because we sit down and we don't use our bodies properly. We don't have that. You know, you talked about we often see images of African tribes women walking along very tall with carrying a basket of goods on their head and being able to balance it perfectly. I reckon that most people, if you put a teacup on the head, they wouldn't be able to balance it for more than 10 seconds, let alone walking for miles. That shows that the whole spine is perfectly in line and the whole body is moving as one to keep this balanced up there, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've done some research on this in Uganda, actually. So whenever I'm researching and coaching athletes when I travel, I'm also looking at people who don't run but that do amazing things with their bodies. And actually, I've worked with ladies in Uganda to study how they can carry huge amounts of weight on their head. You know, two guys have actually got to lift it up onto them, onto their head, but then they can walk 3 or 4 miles and then someone's got to lift it off at the other side. It's so heavy. So this sea of tension in your body, if you get it right, it makes you incredibly strong. It doesn't just make you elastic, it makes you incredibly strong. And part of my research has been to go out and live in Nepal with a community of Sherpas, high altitude Sherpas, and many Everest summits between them. And, you know, some of these guys can carry twice their body weight for a day. Incredible, absolutely incredible. But if you look at them, there's not a great deal of muscle, not muscle in the way that we would see strength and our idea of muscle, but they can do incredible things with their body. So yeah, it's getting that kind of sea of tension right. And you know, it's not our fault. You know, we've been thrust into this new way of life, you know, so we haven't made mistakes or been irresponsible. You know, we don't move well because of the world that we live in now. But what we can do is take that on and do something about it. We just have a little bit of a knowledge about it, I think, and get excited about it. We should, you know, we need to get excited about our running. So if that can filter back into our everyday life to make us better runners, then you really get it.
I sort of might take issue with that slightly. I appreciate that we've been thrust into it, and yet we do still have choices, don't we? You know, you can choose to stand up like we are, or you can choose to take the easy option of sitting down all day, in the same way that you can choose to have a salad for dinner or you can choose to have a McDonald's. And so we do still have choices. It's just that perhaps it's not our fault that people have found ways to give us easier options, so that we can spend more time sat in front of the TV watching Netflix. So it is still a matter of choice, isn't it? It's not completely, we can't completely disown that responsibility.
It is a choice, but you have to know two pieces of information to make a choice on them. So if we don't know that we should really be weight bearing and that our body's in a sea of tension and that rejuvenation of the body really takes place when we're weight bearing, if we don't know that, we can't make the choice. And I don't think we really know that. I don't think that's on our kind of horizon, really. So I think you're right. Once you've got two pieces of information, then we do need to do the responsible thing. And that's what certainly my work is about, is trying to get that information out so that someone can say, wow, okay, I didn't know that. Right. Well, if that's the case, then maybe I should be stood.
So if we watch children run and you see them playing in the park and running after each other and playing football, most children run naturally. You know, they've got a high cadence, they run fast, their heels kick up, they can change direction quickly. And so that seems natural. Nobody's sort of grabbed hold of them and taken them to one side and say, look, you must do this, you must land on your forefoot, or you must not heel strike. They just do it naturally, and they're able to, you know, if you watch them in the summer running on the grass, or you watch them running on the beach, they're running barefoot as well most of the time, but they're not getting injured. But if that's the most natural thing in the world, something's happening between the ages of 5 and 6 and the age of 18, 19 and 20, when all of a sudden people aren't running like they were when they were 15 years younger. Now, I guess you're probably going to tell me that's got to do with all of those things we've just mentioned.
Completely. It's down to their perception of their movement starts to change, and they start to sit down more at school and stuff. So absolutely, they are products of their environment and the information that they're subjected to. So with no knowledge and allowed to move around freely, they move like little humans, which is what they're designed to do. The moment you start to, you start to educate them out their movement for rightly or wrongly, then they're going to start thinking differently about their movement, and they're going to start sitting more because they're in classrooms and stuff like that. So it's the perfect example. But you're right, we should all try and emulate a five-year-old, because they move with just complete relaxation and inhibition, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
You mentioned that coach that you saw in Ethiopia, was it? Where
Coach Senteo, yeah.
And he'd worked with Tirunesh Dibaba. Now, I love to show the Tirunesh Dibaba video. There's somebody had broken down her stride, and you know, she's just got such a beautiful running technique. And I will share that video, because I love watching that one. And actually, the person who's done it has actually put little captions on to sort of illustrate, you know, high leg kick, foot landing under the body, minimal tension in the quadriceps. So we look at her, but then we can look at another runner. There's another African runner that runs, and she's got a terrible dish. You can see her left leg flick out. I've even heard Paula Radcliffe say nobody wants to run near her in case they get flicked on the leg by her when she's running. So you'd look at one and say, that's a beautiful running style. You'd look at another one and say, that looks a bit untidy. And yet they're running side by side. And I guess if you put them into the lab, their running economy would be very similar. They have similar performances. So are we able to construct a model of what is running naturally and what's right and what we should be aiming for? You know, can you take somebody like Dibaba and say, we all need to try and work towards a technique like this?
I think the things for us to remember is, not many of us are going to race Tirunesh Dibaba, but what we all want to do is be the best runner that we can be, without a doubt. And I think so. It's important what we learn from elites, we bring back down into what we all want to do. And that's whether you're trying to break 3 hours for the marathon or 30 minutes for a park run or whatever it is. So the thing is with humans, what I have learned is that for humans, for you and I and anybody listening, your movement is like your fingerprint. It is different to anybody else's on the planet. That's why this work is so fascinating, if it's even work. That's why it's so fascinating, because everybody moves in a completely different way to other people. We're just basically an accumulation of idiosyncrasies and contraindications that we've built up throughout our life that make our movement. So what we're all trying to do is maximize the potential of the hand that we've been dealt. Okay, so if you have a runner where the leg does flick out, then you might say, yes, that isn't efficient, because really good movement is about trying to maximize the balance and symmetry in your body. So if you have a leg that flicks out, then that is going to detract from some of that balance and symmetry and have an effect on your efficiency. But that's what happens to that person. That's probably actually the cue angle in the leg from the hip down to the femur. That's often what creates that kind of flick. But you've got that, and that's what you've got. So we should. I think the important message is here is that yes, there is a way that we would want a human to run. Yeah, there's a way where the foot should land. There's a certain thing we should do with our arms. We want to load the elastic system. We want the head in the right position. We want the right cadence. All of these things we pursue to get right. But we shouldn't beat ourselves up if we're not moving like Tirunesh Dibaba. because, you know, not a lot of people do. But we can all aspire to maximize our potential to move as well as a human can move. So we shouldn't, you know, a lot of people, I think, give up because they just don't think they're doing it right, because they're not doing it the way they see other people do it. It's about maximizing your potential.
I see some interesting synergies here with what you were saying with swimming, because that this is another thing that, you know, people, triathletes particularly, want to swim faster, and they're always looking at models. You know, that you might look at Swim Smooth, or you might look at Total Immersion. I'm not sure whether you've heard of those, Shane, but they're just,
I know them.
They're ways of swimming in the same way that pose running is a model of you know how to run better. But I see people saying, oh, yeah, well, how's he swimming so fast? Because he's doing this or he's doing that. You know, somebody will look at Alistair Brownie and say, well, he's got a straight arm recovery. That's what I've always been told, to have a bent arm recovery. So how's he swimming so fast? But there are certain fundamental principles that all the best swimmers are doing. How they're getting into those positions. So we talked, going back to running now, we talked about the heel flick or the sort of dish kick that female runner has. But there are certain things about, you know, her arm position, her head position, her body position, her cadence, etc., the way her foot lands, that you could actually apply to all of them, aren't there? And then there are other differences as well. So maybe we can talk about what those fundamental principles are that we all need to try and get right.
Yeah, and one thing I would say about running and swimming as well is that, you know, I think it's probably harder to be a swimming coach than it is a running coach, because we're actually designed to run, whereas swimming, I really think that was what Mother Nature really had in mind. We have a lateral line, but so I think it's, you know, with swimming, it's probably a different thought process, because you're trying to create efficiency and dynamic for something that we're not actually designed to do. Whereas with running, we are.
But still, to your point there as well, and back to your bit about human movement, if you spend all day kinked up, your body's not going to be in the most streamlined, elongated positions it could be, as if you're good at movement. So if somebody was actually going to start using some of your principles for improving their running, they might find it improves their swimming as well, because they just happen to move better.
It'll improve the way they make a cup of tea. I mean, if you stand and make a cup of tea with, you know, with good equilibrium in the body and a good sea of tension, it's going to be an easier task. So every single thing that you do, running is just an extension of doing all the good things that we should be doing as we move around every day, without a doubt.
So what are the basic principles? I know you've talked about one, about the tripod landing position, you know, the sort of the triangle you can draw under the base of the foot. So I guess that would be one of the fundamentals.
I think it's one that everyone can start to think about straight away. So when, you know, when I'm coaching, what I see is I like to think as the foot is essentially the interface between you and the ground. Okay. And like any good interface, everything that goes on behind it is only as good as that interface. Really, if that interface doesn't work well, then we're always going to have a problem. So, and you know, there's a lot of talk about foot. I think, you know, heel strike has been pretty much demonized, and I think most people would agree, if of course they've looked into it, that heel strike isn't good. Of course, many people won't have a view or an idea either way, because they're just run. But heel strike is being demonized, and I think that's true. I don't think we should land on our heel. But I also don't think that we should be landing on our forefoot either. Okay, I don't think that's good. I think if you're sprinting, you know, for a very short period of time, you can get up on your forefoot and that'll be okay. But if you're running for any period of time, then I don't think you can do that.
Can I jump in there? Because people will probably point, you know, triathletes in particular will probably point to Alistair Brownlee here and say, well, he looks like he lands on his forefoot there, and it's not held him back, although he's had several operations on his ankles.
Well, I was just about to say, maybe it has, because if you run constantly on your forefoot, you're going to pay for that with injuries. Mm-hmm. You're really going to struggle, because the ankle, the Achilles, the muscles in the posterior chain on the back of the leg, soleus, gastrocnemius, you're asking them to constantly do a job that they're not really designed to do. So, you know, we've got to have an eye here on performance, but also the ability to get up and do it again tomorrow. So, listen, he's a great runner, and I wouldn't be telling him how to run, but if I was working with them, my advice would be to get more of what I would call a tripod landing, so that that posterior chain isn't doing so much of the work, and the glutes get to do a little bit more.
In fairness, I think they have worked to bring the landing back towards the midfoot, you know, because of those foot injuries.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense.
I've not been involved with that, but we're talking about midfoot landing. We've sort of suggested that heel striking probably isn't, and forefoot. So, but again, you hear people saying, "Well, I'm a midfoot lander," and they're deliberately trying to engineer something so that they're landing on the midfoot. Whereas Ross Tucker did a whole review of running techniques and barefoot running, which had a great deal of popularity a few years ago, and now I hear a lot of people talking about, it's not about what part of the foot lands, it's about the position of the lower leg and how that lands. Or are those two completely?
No, I don't think that because you could land. I guess if you land in the right place, it will certainly get the foot landing better, because just by default, because of your kinetic chain, the foot is more likely to land in a better place. But you can still get your foot down and land on a heel or on a forefoot, you know, whatever position, especially if that's what you're trying to do because you think that's what you've got to do. We can make ourselves do anything. So I think it's absolutely essential that the foot lands in the right way. Where it lands is important too, but as I say, you can do one without the other. So I think we need to think about that landing. And I think sometimes the terminologies can be a little bit misleading as well, because I work a lot with runners on perception of movement, and if I get them to tell me about what a midfoot land is, they will still they will actually show me on a foot that it's still the front of the foot. Yeah. They see it as the still the front part of the foot, not the heel coming down at all. So even the terminologies midfoot, forefoot, heel, you know, there's lots of terminologies, and it's our perception of what that terminology is. So even a lot of people who will say, yeah, I want to run on my midfoot, that's what I want to do, when you actually get them to point at a foot and show you what it is they're doing, they're actually still forefoot landing.
I've started to do a bit of skipping, and it always feels to me when you're skipping that's the landing that you get where the midfoot hits the ground slightly before the heel. And as the heel just comes down, you're loading the Achilles then like a spring, and then you're able to bounce back up from that. If you were to try skipping or jumping on the spot on just your heels, you'd have virtually no bounce at all, and it would all be coming through and it'd be putting so much shock through the bones. And if you try to land right on the forefoot, almost on that toe joint, you just don't get any spring either. So actually the most efficient way to load up the springs and that tension that you talk about is to midfoot slightly before the heel. I don't know whether you can demonstrate that with that little foot that you have.
Well, I think the heel should come down at the same time. So so the heel is the third part of the tripod. Right. Skipping isn't running.
No.
So they're two different things. So I think when you're skipping, you are going to be on your forefoot, and your heel isn't really going to make that much of a contact with the ground. Okay. But running is a completely different motion from skipping.
Okay.
Completely. So one of the big things we want from our footfall as the interface is stability. And we use tripods for stability. Yeah, my iPad is actually on a tripod now. You can't see that, but it is. And so if we land essentially on two points of our tripod, if we were 4 foot landing, then we wouldn't have much stability. If we landed on our heel, then we're actually only on one point of that tripod. So I think when we're running, you know, if you're sprinting, you can get away with being on the 4 foot because it's not for very long. But actually, if you're out there for any length of time, really 400 meters on, then actually the tripod landing will give you that stability. And not only does that mean the body hasn't got to work above the foot to create that stability, it also means the foot's on the ground for less time because stability is found quicker. So your ground contact time is reduced. And that's incredibly important for dynamic movement. Also, there's a quarter of a million nerve endings on the bottom of the foot. If we get that full foot or that tripod landing, we're maximizing the nerve endings. Also, if you look at the arch of the foot, if you land on a tripod landing, you get to maximize the arch of the foot. The arch of the foot is essentially the core stability for the foot. The more you load that arch, the stronger it becomes. That's why we use arches in architecture. So landing with a tripod creates good strength in the foot. And also, if that's not enough, the shape of the foot, if you look at your foot, it's actually shaped like a dome. The arch of the foot makes the foot shape like a dome. If you land on your tripod, the dome effect of the foot spreads the impact out. It spreads the weight out. Again, that's why we use domes in architecture. And if that wasn't enough, you have something called the plantar fascia on the bottom of the foot, which is a beautiful piece of elastic. Ah. If you land on a tripod landing, you're going to load that plantar fascia to give you spring. So it might not, and again, this, it comes down to perception and it comes down to intuition. It's more intuitive to feel more springy on the front of your foot. But actually, I don't believe that's the case. It's just, we just feel like that.
Back to fascia again there. And I guess that's probably the only interaction most people have had with that word is if they get plantar fasciitis. Yeah. And,
which is a shame because I'm scared of it.
So how would I know if I'm running badly? I mean, if I'm running along, you know, I live right by the canal here, so I can run along the towpath. And if I sit in my bay window with my coffee, I can watch runners all day long. And man, we could have a field day discussing the techniques that we see as people run past there, you know, because we get the performance squad running along there. So you'll get the Brownleys and some of the other guys. And then you've got the recreational runners who've just started running in lockdown. And, well, we've got the whole range. But some of those runners will probably say to me, well, I feel quite comfortable. I don't think there's anything wrong. So again, back to perception of movement. Yeah. So if they don't get injured, don't have any niggles around the knees or their ankle or the calf or the hips, and they can run along chattering away, would they not then think, well, actually, I'm running all right, and so why do I need to change?
Yep, they would definitely think that. And I think you might think if it's not broken, don't fix it. And also, you might not, your perception of your movement can be very different from the real thing. So, yeah, you can be running along in absolute bliss, potentially not moving well, but never know it. Absolutely. And I think that's the biggest challenge of all for runners is A, to understand what good movement is, and B, to understand what you're doing. Very, very difficult, but actually it's very simple, I think. And we can all do this, and that's video ourselves.
Well, I was just going to jump in because that's, again, coming back to the swimming model, that's what we say to people is to know what you need to change, you need to know what you look like first, and you also need to have a model of what you need to move towards. So again, that two pieces of information that you talked about.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I use some very clever technology when I'm coaching and researching, but the most powerful thing I use is video analysis, without a doubt. I remote coach, you know, I coach online remotely on 6 continents with runners all around the world who send me in their video analysis, and then we kind of work on that and critique that together. That's an incredibly powerful way of running. You can change somebody's movement in America just by sharing the video and working on the video together. So if you and I were buddies, there's absolutely nothing to stop us. Well, kind of our bonding.
I was going to say, I hope we are now.
There's absolutely nothing to stop us running up and down your towpath. And then after a little while, just get our phones out and video each other. And so a lot of my work now is based on this. So I've created this coaching site where it essentially inspires people to do exactly this. Go out, video each other, have a look at how you're moving. And then on the coaching site, there's lots of videos about maybe how you should be doing it and the thought processes behind why you should be doing it, which you can take out on your phone as well. So you can be running around, video each other, look at the videos, look at what you're doing, and then look at the kind of library of videos to understand if you're doing it well or not, have some practice, and then video yourself again. You know, really, the best coach anyone can have is themselves. It really is, and I'm a coach, so you think, well, why would you say that? Because actually, you know, that might not be good for your business. But actually, you know, it's true. Only you can feel what you feel. You can look at data, a coach can look at data, you can look at video, the coach can look at video, but only you feel, only you are there on every training run and there on the race. So I think we can all change our perception of our movement immediately by doing 10 seconds of video.
you've just mentioned something there that another guest was talking with me about last week. We were talking about artificial intelligence, actually, and how training programs are using artificial intelligence to try and pull together all the data to then give you some sort of prediction on maybe today's an easy day, you know, make the training more dynamic. And actually, although that system requires a lot of data, which is objective, you know, when we've got our Garmins and the video and everything else, the three most important pieces of data they've got were subjective, like how does it feel? So you could go out, you talk there about sitting down. You could do a run today and the sun's out and you could feel $1 million because you've spent, you've been for a walk, you've done a bit of gardening, you've been moving around, and then you go out running and your body's loose and you've been moving naturally and you go out and run. And then you go out and run next week and it's raining or you've been sat in the car all day, and the same run might even run at the same pace, but your perception of effort or your perception of your movement is terrible. That's about perception, isn't it? That's not recorded by your Garmin or your Suunto or any other piece of data. It's recorded by what this more expensive piece of data that we've got in our head or gadgetry. Yeah. And I'm sort of sad, really, that most people that come into sport these days tend to go for the gadgets first to collect data before they've learned. I'm not against gadgets and data collection, but I do think that we need to understand what our body's doing through listening to it and that perception before we start to get into recording the data objectively.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm coaching, so if you came to the pavilion and we did a coaching session together, there would be three pillars to the way that we would work together. There would be the video analysis, there would be some data, and there would be absolutely your perception, how you feel when you're moving. If you put those three things together, that's incredibly powerful, because you have to see how you move and you have to feel how it feels to do it right, as well as see yourself do it right. But it really helps as well to trap some relatively basic data on, because that tells you what you felt. You know, you do need to feel it, but you need to know what you felt. So I think that all three are really important. I think the big thing is data shouldn't tell you how to run. It should tell you how you ran. So, you know, any data generally has software attached to it, and that software has to be relatively generic because it's for a lot of runners. So I think the trick is with any data is to learn to take the headline figures and then use them with your running intelligence. Any data, there tends to be a very kind of organic coefficient between the data, headline data, that you just got to learn as an intelligent runner how to take that information and work with it, not necessarily let the artificial intelligence tell you what to do. I think, you know, we're in a great place as runners, because when I first started, you couldn't measure oscillation or stride length, or ground contact time. You know, you just couldn't do it. And even in the 10 years I've been coaching, you just couldn't do that. And now we all can if we want to. And that shouldn't tell us how to move, but it should tell us how we are moving and be able to give us some really interesting information as to whether we're making progress. And this is another reason why people can really start to, with a bit of guidance, coach themselves.
You mentioned some of the data we can record there, and you talked about cadence. Is there an optimal cadence? Because you see this talked about quite a lot, and I hear people saying, well, I'm trying to aim for 90 foot strikes per minute with my left leg. Is that very much individual dependent?
Well, so two things. Firstly, running around a 90, so essentially counting your left foot strikes or your right foot strikes, I think is a really bad thing to do, because it will make you just hit. It will make you just try and hit with the left leg or just with the right leg, whichever is the one that's on the count. And I can actually see people running down the road, and I can see that they're doing it. Right, They will almost certainly do it on their stabilizing leg, their non-kicking leg. And so you can actually, and that tends to be people's left, although if people are left, their stabilizer would be their right. But you can actually see people running, hitting the ground in a very kind of unbalanced way, because they're just counting that every other. So you must have, and I know triathletes from a bike point of view, they half their cadence. So a 180 for a runner would be a 90 for a cyclist. But if you're a triathlete or anybody, you must look at your cadence as each footfall. If you do it every other, you'll start moving in a really asymmetric way.
Wow.
So That's one big thing. With regards to cadence, so for anybody who doesn't know who's listening, cadence is how many times your feet hit the ground in a minute. And the figure of 180 is always kind of talked about as the optimum cadence. I think for me, for the work I've done, and I've worked with over 3,000 runners one-to-one and recorded data from them, and for me, I think the optimum cadence is between 175 and 185. That's where you'd want to be. Now, cadence has been hijacked a little bit in recent years, and it's been used to correct form. Okay, and a lot of runners are running around at a 180 cadence because they think that will give them good form, but it doesn't. Okay. Of the 3,000 runners that I've worked with one-to-one, the average cadence before coaching was 163. Okay. So let's say that's not a bad cross-section of people in the Western world. 3,000 runners, that's quite a lot of runners. The average cadence, the mean figure was 163. And 84% of those were landing on a heel on a straight leg. Okay. So if there is an average runner, there isn't. But if there was an average runner, they would probably be running around at a 163 cadence, landing on a heel on a straight leg over striding. And so what people have started to do is get a metronome, stick that metronome on runners, get them turning over their feet quicker so that they don't land on their heel anymore. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's a little bit like sticking a plaster over a fracture. It doesn't really do change anything because the moment the runner, because now the runner has got quicker steps, but little steps. That's why they're landing more underneath them. But the moment they try and run fast, they're just going to overstride out in front of themselves again. So adjusting your cadence to correct your form is not what it's about.
So that's one of the things I've noticed, because I can run along a towpath here. It's nice and flat. I can go and run on the football fields. Is that when I run slower, when I run at my easy pace, my cadence is lower. When I run at my faster pace, my cadence is higher. And I don't actually count that very often, but I can. My little watch will tell me what that cadence is, you know, from my foot strikes or from my counter movement of my arms. So I can see that the cadence is up nearer to 90 when I'm running faster and it's down nearer to 83, 84 when I'm running slower. So sure. is that what should happen?
Well, so the reason we'd want to be in between 175 and 185 is that when you're running, as a human, when your foot hits the ground, you've got around about 2.5 times your body weight coming back at you. So Newton's third law, any actions met by an equal and opposite. So for a runner, it's about 2.5 times your body weight coming back at you. That's actually a beautiful thing. We're all scared of impact, but that's bad. We should love impact because that impact coming back at you, providing you're moving well, turns into elastic energy, and that elastic energy throws you forward. But the elastic energy you create by hitting the ground has a frequency. Everything has a frequency. So you hit the ground and create elastic energy in the body. That elastic energy is stored for a split second and then it's released. So Mother Nature's idea was you land, you create impact, you store it as your foot goes through the stride on the ground, and then as your foot leaves the ground, the elastic energy fires. If you run at a cadence between 175 and 185, I believe you are synchronizing in with the elastic frequency of your body. So you wouldn't want to give that away. That's too good. Yeah, that's too good. Because remember, the elastic energy doesn't really want any oxygen or calories or produce lactate. So in the ideal world, we should always try and keep in between 175 and 185 when we're running from a cadence zone and then use stride length to go faster or slower.
Right.
Your current model, you're using cadence more to go fast. So you might not really increase your stride much. You'll just do more of them. But that can mean that you could go in and out of your fascial frequency. So in an ideal world, if you were running along the towpath at a 175 cadence relatively quickly, you'd have a stride length of maybe 1.3 meters. Yeah. If you wanted to go slower, you would keep your cadence the same, but now come down to a 1.1 meter stride length. And if you went really slowly, down to maybe a 0.9 meter stride. Then if you wanted to go fast again, you would open up your stride length. In reality, your cadence does go up and down as you go faster and slower, but it shouldn't be the main means of going faster and slower. Does that make sense?
It does. And I mean, there's really only two ways to go faster, isn't there? Increase your stride frequency or increase your stride length.
Yeah, and trying harder as well, you know. So, we, you know, essentially you get out of the ground what you put into it. So more, creating more into the ground and creating more spring from the ground also creates more stride length. You know, think of your stride as a curve, a big curve for a long stride and a small curve for a small stride and everything in between. So how you leave the ground will determine how good that curve is. You want a nice efficient curve. You don't want a bell curve because that means you're just bouncing up and down. You want a lot of forward trajectory within that oscillation that you're creating. So your relationship with the ground, how you hit it and how you leave it, is incredibly important. And you can adjust those to create your stride length. What we tend to do is turn our feet over quicker and just try harder. Clench our jaw, grip our hands and just probably bend from the waist and just try really hard. And that's a very limited, you're then tapping into a very limited energy source. And that's often why we can't do it for very long.
Okay, right. So we've got some of the principles in place. I come to you and I say, Shane, look, I've got some video stuff here that I've done. You have a look at it. We agree that there are some changes that I need to make. Does this all start with a movement program? So we leave my running as it is, and I start with a movement program. Or we're going to do stuff concurrently.
So, yeah. So if you came to the pavilion, how we would do it is we would get you, we'd say hello, how are you doing, how was the traffic, all of the usual stuff, and then we'd, without any real discussion, we'd just get you running around. Okay. Different speeds, and I do video analysis of that from the side, from the back, from the front, but at various speeds. And then we would look at that video analysis together, because it's incredibly important that when you have your analysis done, you're moving just the way that you move. So because you move largely based on your perception, even a 10-minute chat can change somebody's perception of their movement. So, you know, you really don't want that to be contaminated. Actually, the work's fascinating now, because of course many people come because they've read the book, so of course they can't unknow what they know, so they are moving with the perception of movement now. So that's been really interesting. So, but that's how it would work. You would run around, lots of video, look at that video together, and we might find that your foot isn't landing so well, your left arm isn't doing what your right arm is doing, and your head position isn't great. So we'd identify those. But what we would also do, what I would also say, we, it's just me, what I would also do is celebrate what's good. So, you know, and again, we beat ourselves up far too much. Good coaching, good analysis is about celebrating what's good as well as what's not good. And because if you know why you do something well, you're a lot more likely to do it even better, because nobody's the finished article. You know, I get to work with world record holders in Africa, and it's not about, or, you know, they do a lot of stuff very, very well. It's about trying to get them to understand why it's amazing so that it can be even better. So you analyze, you look at what's good, and you look at what needs to be worked on. And then once that's identified, then we have the kind of discussions we're having now. So we would look at a model of the foot. We would discuss why we would want the foot landing in the right way. We'd look at video analysis of people that are doing it well to get a good visual of what needs to be done. And then when we're ready, off you go, and you practice that. Yeah, and that practice is videoed. And so we start to build up this thought process of how it feels to do it well, how it looks to do it well, and we may capture some data on that as well to look at some of the dynamics.
Would that require somebody to reduce their running volume then while they're changing the technique? Because I know a lot of people be like, "Whoa, I don't really want to run unless if it's, you know, if it means I've got to cut back on my running in order to become faster."
Yeah, this is a massive challenge. I mean, yeah, I mean, most people, you know, a lot of people come and they're on training plans, and they've obviously got a coach who's sat on the other end of training heats, wait to see what they did and how it went, and quite rightly so, because they're coaching them and they're excited and they want them to do well. But you know, one of the big things to remember about, so if you and I did a session and then you went off tomorrow to start to learn what, you know, put into practice what you learn, if you change your movement, you're not really changing muscle memory. You know, if you start to change your movement, we tend to think of it as muscle memory. Muscles don't really remember anything. They might get strong at a task, but they don't really know what's going on. They're really not that interested. They can't remember what they did this morning. It's our very clever software, our brain, that tells the muscles what to do. So changing your movement is a software tweak. It's a software change. So if you were to go out tomorrow and practice what you and I had learned today, and the first 3 miles of that run, you were running beautifully, doing all of the things that we discussed, that would be great. But if the last 7 miles was back to your default, in reality, it's going to be tough to change that software because the bulk of it was done the old way. So it's always a challenge. It's always going to be a challenge to keep up the mileage and change the movement. It can be done, but you've just got to accept it's a very cognitive thing. Now, what you can do is in the early stages is just do shorter sessions and more often to start rewriting it. And then actually when you're running longer distances, and you have to okay this with your coach, but when you're running longer distances, when you do become cardiovascularly challenged, because it can be harder at first, and that's your perception of effort mainly, or cognitively you're just, you feel as though you're losing track of everything, just walk for 100 meters. Catch your breath, reset your software, get everything ready, and then go again. And then that way you're either creating software for beautiful running or walking, not this grey area in the middle.
So that's something that Louise has spoken about, is just stop, reset, do some running drills, perhaps just to recapture that running stride that you're trying to create, and then start running again rather than losing it and carrying on with the technique you want to move away from.
Yeah, I mean, one thing there, and this is subjective, but for me, if running is a software change, if you run around and do drills, you're potentially contaminating your software, because running is the full body movement. The fingertips on your left hand are connected to the toes on your right foot. And so when you run, everything is taking part. We've already discussed that. If you were to run around isolating just one part of your body or one limb to do a drill, you are potentially contaminating your software, because it wants to see everything as a full body movement. And I think drills only work if you take the biomechanical view of, you're teaching your right leg to do something to get that. If you wanted to get your foot down earlier underneath you or whatever it might be, and you're just running around doing a movement that's getting that happening, the rest of the body isn't taking part, and running is the full body thing. So for me, a drill would be 400 meters of the whole body making the correct movement, but cognitively being aware of maybe the limb or the part of the body that you're thinking that you want to work on, that I don't think we should just isolate it in a drill type movement.
Oh, that's interesting. That would fly in the face of what a lot of running coaches would have people doing, wouldn't it?
Of course, yeah. And listen, they might be right and I might be wrong. But yes, my thoughts are different. A lot of my thoughts are different, to be fair. But yeah, I don't see the benefit personally of just running around and just doing one thing with one limb. I think we should try and get the whole body making the whole movement, but maybe just be cognitive about what that actual limb is doing.
I'm just going to show you now, Shane, one of the drills that we do, which is to be in a position where you get into the runner's stride. So you can't really see it here, but my knees come up.
Yep.
So I've got triple flexion there, flexion at the hip, flexion at the knee, and I've got my foot in the position where my shoelaces are up, so my foot's parallel to the ground. Yep. And then I would walk. And so it is a full body movement, but I'm walking and then almost holding the pose for a couple of seconds. And that was, you know, that's one of the drills that Alison and Louisa coach, to just try and get the body and the foot and everything in the right pattern. Obviously, you have to then move that on to a sort of an integrated running drill. You can't just do that sort of robotic type movement.
Yeah, I can see the thoughts behind it. The thing is, it doesn't take into account deceleration or impact or actual range of motion for running. I don't think so much to do with running. What I would rather, for me, I mean, listen, we all work in different ways. I'm always keen to learn from everybody. But for me, if you ran for just 100 meters and really concentrated on what you were doing, that means more to your software and more to building specific strength to the body, because, you know, I think that's far more relevant. But listen, some of the best athletes in the world go around and do those types of drills. So, you know, they're probably right, but that's my thought process.
Well, and I come back to swimming here, but I see a lot of swimmers doing lots and lots of drills, but never getting any better. because they're never really doing any swimming. They're never really putting it into action. They're trying to break everything down into individual silos. But obviously,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
nothing
exactly.
operates like that. And also, I would add that there are lots of roads leading to Rome, aren't there? And it doesn't mean that one is the best way. You know, there are you can take 10 triathlon coaches and they will have a different way of coaching people, but they will all be able to get the best out of that person. So it's down to the individual. And again, you probably, if you break it down, find that whether you do running drills or not, there's still some fundamental principles that you're trying to adhere to, which take you to the same place.
Completely. And, you know, when I my first trip was to Africa for my research, but I've been to Africa many, many times over the last 10 years, lots of times to Ethiopia and Kenya. And you know, I think, you know, generally the Ethiopians would do more drill work like that kind of thing. And the Kenyans, not so much. And yet they race each other and it's normally pretty close. And so, yeah. You know, there probably is, you know, I think that's the fascinating thing about sport, about movement, about all of these things is, you know, there is more than one way. And anybody who just stands up and says, look, I know what it is. And you know, I'm the guru and you've got to follow what I say. I don't think that would be great. I think we can all learn from each other, but I think you have to go with what you see and be passionate about that. And as long as you truly believe it and you're not just trying to reinvent the wheel, then I think you have to go with it. But we should all learn and listen to each other.
I mean, for my own personal situation, I've had a lot of Achilles and calf problems over the years. And, you know, I'm 57 now. I hear a lot of guys in their 50s say, well, it's just inevitable. It's part of the aging process. I didn't want to believe that. And so I've got to the point now where I can actually run without any calf and Achilles pain. I'm not running particularly fast, but I am. And this is something Malcolm Brown talks about. And I've repeated this so many times now, people be getting bored with it. But Malcolm says, you need to just enjoy running first. Don't worry about the watch. Don't worry about your technique. Just go and run in the woods and enjoy the experience of being at one with nature and interacting with nature. And then start to, you know, when you've been doing that regularly, then start to worry about performance. And I have really started to enjoy my running. But for me, if I've been working and I've been sat down, because I do tend to sit down for certain tasks, then I want to have a transition, if you like, between running and non-running or sedentary. And that transition for me is for doing some agility drills, using the ladders and the hurdles, for moving in different directions, for doing some running drills, for working up building my heart rate, because it takes me from being inactive to active. And I am concerned about not getting injured. We mentioned this right at the beginning about people going around thinking about not getting injured. But when you've had a lot of time of being injured, you want to preserve that, particularly as you get older, because I've observed that you tend to lose fitness quicker and it takes longer to recover it when you get older. And also getting injured is frustrating and painful and expensive.
Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, let's face it, you know, in reality, as you get older, the body the fascial system, the rejuvenation and re-architecting of bone, muscle and fascia decline. They do. They happen until the very end, right? Until you go to that great running track in the sky. It's happening, but it does get slower as you get older, and that's life. You know, we do take age with us, but it never stops happening. And so we mustn't just get to the stage where we think, well, actually it's damage limitation from now on, because every single runner, it doesn't matter how old they are, their body will rejuvenate and re-architect itself based on how they broke it down. And so it's what I call in the book as Darwinian fitness. Not cardiovascular fitness, but fitness, the body's ability to perform the task. That is happening for every single runner all around the world every single day. And we must not get to the stage where we think, right, now it's just damage limitation. And it's that use it or lose it. You know, if you move, you get stronger. Of course, you want to move well so that you load the body well. But yeah. We can all learn. That's what this is all about. We can all learn to do that. So no runner should be thinking, well, that's it, you know, I'm not going to do it anymore because I'm going to break myself, or, you know, I've just got to accept I'm getting on a bit, so, you know, it's going to decline. It doesn't have to. It really doesn't have to.
No, I agree. I think that's definitely a metaphor for my high-performance human life. Is there's some aging things that we can't stop, you know, but yeah. There's an awful lot that we can do to mitigate those or to sort of make them go slower, you know, and that's for cognition, you know, sleep, anything else, that there's nothing that's really, we shouldn't be thinking that these things are absolutely inevitable. We can do something to stop them, and that includes exercise. And that's my inspiration now. Is not to go sub 10 hours in an Ironman. It's still to be doing a triathlon when I'm in my 70s, like some of my friends, and thinking, well, why shouldn't I? You know, because I get lots of people. I have lots of conversations with people who say, well, my neighbours just think I'm mad because I shouldn't be doing stuff my age now. I had a conversation with a gentleman I'm coaching at the moment. He's 67. His big race for this year has just been put back and he can't do it. So he said, well, I'm going to do it next year and I'll be 68. And my children are saying, well, don't you think you're too old for this, Dad? But of course, if he stops, that will be the death knell. When he stops doing that sort of stuff, that is when the big decline starts to happen.
Yeah, and the great thing about the triathlon is the whole age grouping thing. That's the point, isn't it? You can just go and go and go, and you're racing people around you of a similar age. So you don't have to stop being competitive. But, you know, you've got to enjoy it. And, you know, I work with a lot of elite athletes. I work with complete beginners and elite athletes and everybody in between. But I work with a lot of runners who have forgotten to enjoy it. You know, yeah. And I guess sponsors and having to win and PBs and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, they probably got into running because they loved it and then got really good at it. And then actually the love is in danger of going because, you know, it's become serious. But, you know, we can talk about oscillation, we can talk about stride length, fascia, all of those things. But boy, just get out and run and enjoy it, because it is it's an amazing thing to do.
I think, again, we talked about Alistair and Johnny Brownlee, and you can see Malcolm's influence there a little bit. But they have the similar philosophies. If we weren't doing this because we're professional triathletes, we'd still be doing this anyway, you know, because we just love it.
I get that from that. Yeah, I mean, I haven't had the privilege to meet them, but yeah, I certainly get that they love their sport and they're passionate about it and excited about it. And that's gotta make a difference. That's something that I don't think you can train in. I think, you know, that's clearly one of the reasons why they've been done so well.
Human performance isn't just related to enjoying the sport, though, is it? And cardiovascular fitness. We've maybe touched on strength and conditioning. Nutrition is a part of that. And when we talk about the African runners, they probably have their diet is still quite a long way away from what we now come to accept as a traditional Western diet. Although, again, I know things are probably changing. Sleep and mindset are also part of that package. Do you get involved with coaching any of those, or do you have any people you outsource to, or do you just leave that to the athletes to sort out?
Well, yeah, I mean, all I can do, I mean, I don't, you know, I coach movement, so that's all I would actually coach. But you, when I'm in the African training camps and living with the African runners, you know, you certainly pick up a lot of what happens. And what I find fascinating, you know, if I'm in a training camp in Kenya, they might get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then they might say, let's say that today it's a 30K tempo run. So they go off on their 30K tempo run. And I do mean tempo. I mean, I chase them on a motorbike or a four-wheel drive. It's the only way you can keep anywhere near them. And so they go off and they do their tempo run. They come back, they have something to eat and then something to drink. And then they excitedly go to sleep. Because they know that's when fitness comes to find them. Now, they are full-time athletes, and of course, you know, most people aren't. And so we have life, homeschooling, or jobs, or whatever it might be. So we can't all just go for a run and then go to sleep. But what it does show is that, you know, we have access to all the sports science and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, really, I don't think we get enough that actually fitness, from the Darwinian fitness I would describe as the body re-architecting itself to do the task, and cardiovascular fitness, they rely a lot on recovery. And if we just don't stop running long enough to recover, we're never really going to get fit. And we're actually going to break down our bodies trying to do it. So I think we suffer from guilt. And I think that's a Western thing, a North American thing, that we feel guilty if we're not strength and conditioning, or if we're not running, or if we're not rolling or stretching or something. I mean, we now live in a very voyeuristic kind of environment where everyone's posting what they're doing and you can all see it. And even if you're not posting, you might be thinking, wow, they've done 80 miles this week, and they're, you know, and they're foam rolling, and now they're stretching, and now they're doing yoga, and, you know, all of these things. But just never stop long enough to actually recover and benefit. And I know when I was in Ethiopia, Some of the ladies will sleep up to 16 hours a day wow. in preparation. Yeah, the professional sleepers. Now, you know, we can't do that. But what it does show us is that actually, if we want to maximize our potential with what we can with our circumstances, we do want to take some time to recover. And this is why I get excited about movement. One of the reasons I get excited about movement, because if you were running, let's say for simple figures, you were running 100 miles a week. If you were going to do an ultra or something like that, you were running 100 miles, or even marathon runners do it, 100 miles a week. That 100 miles a week, I think if every one of those miles you moved well, could be 70 miles a week, because yeah. you're busy building up a big engine that's actually making up for inefficient movement to a degree. Mm-hmm. So you could cut your miles down by 30% because you're actually not going to need such a big engine, because a lot of the propulsion yeah. you're creating is through gravity and elasticity, which doesn't want oxygen. That then gives you more time to recover, which actually gives you time to get fit. So I think, you know, it's we see this no pain, no gain. If it's not hurting, it's not working type thing. And we just got to constantly go, go, go all the time. Sometimes less is more.
You're speaking from my script now, Shane. Absolutely. I if I was to do a review of the, I think we've done, this would be probably the 190th podcast I've done. If I was to do a review of the conversations I've had, sleep would be one of the key things that keeps coming up time and again. Yeah. Enjoyment of your activity and your sport would be another one. Mm. And mobility would probably be another one. You know, three key factors. We're not talking about technical stuff now. We're not talking about how to improve your VO2 max or your threshold or your aerobic capacity. We're talking about, again, basic human principles, are we not athletic principles, but they're the foundation upon which those athletic performances and human performances are built. Yeah, and yeah. It's always refreshing when I hear somebody who's an expert in their particular field coming back to these basic principles, because you can't escape them. They keep coming around so often. Eventually, if they were in a room with them, they'd be bashing you on the head all the time.
We're humans, so, you know, and we've got to maximize our ability as a human, and humans need hydration, they need nutrition, and they need to sleep. You know, they do, so they're fundamentals, aren't they? And they're not what I coach, but I'm well aware of how important they are. And actually, if I was coaching someone, then I would try and inspire them to get more recovery time, you know. But I think it's absolutely massive, absolutely massive.
Right, well, talking of coaching, I know you've got to go off and do some actual work. So a couple of last little things. If we can cover maybe four or five points that we all need to be thinking about. Go on, the floor's yours.
Okay. So from a running point of view, I think if we had some tips or some things to think about, we talked about that tripod landing. Incredibly important that we kind of create that. Think of your foot as the interface between you and the ground. Get outside and video yourself. Yeah. Don't do it on a treadmill. Do it outside on terra firma, because that's where you're going to see your real movement. So, you know, buddy up with somebody, get outside, video yourself running. Start to take ownership of your movement straight away. And then put some research in to understand how you should be moving. Yeah. So start to build up, you know, your ability to coach yourself by understanding how you should be moving. And then I think it's then again about getting outside again and practicing that, and think of it as a software change. It's really, really important that you take this on as a cognitive challenge and not just getting out and doing it a lot and assuming that you'll get better at it because you did it a lot. I think there's an element of getting better at things through repetition, of course. But if you want to maximize your potential, you've really got to think about it as a software change, and then really go through that process of practice, re-video, and I think buddy up and help each other. My next book looks a lot at the how we're powerful as a group and how we can push each other, but at the same time put our arm around each other and help each other. I see that all around the world, certainly in the African training camps and with tribes and indigenous people, very, very good at coming together, pushing each other hard to get things done, but then putting their arm around each other as well. I think we don't have that much in the Western world. And certainly over the last year, that's definitely been challenged, hasn't it? Because we haven't been able to get out in groups.
Yeah.
I think we're all kind of missing that, even if we didn't know it was a strength before. I think we're now kind of thinking, well, we do feed off of each other and it is good. And we are now coming to the end of it. I think it looks good. So we should get out and help each other, coach each other and work together, celebrate what we do well, but help each other work on what's not so good.
Great. I think I've got that. I'll put that into the show notes then. Tripod landing, video yourself, understanding how you should move and practice. Surprised that you didn't have anything like just move more, but I suppose we've talked about that so much, that's almost a given, isn't it?
Sit down less. Yeah, well, we've talked about standing. Yeah, absolutely. I think, I think it's probably a message that we all kind of get. I think even if you move more, probably people thinking they can still sit down all day, but just get up for half an hour and run around a little bit and then come and sit back down again. So I think if you can get people taking ownership of their everyday environment, that's when the big gains come. I really do believe that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of some of the Pavel Satsulin stuff about on the hour, every hour. You know, have one of those little Pomodoro timers, goes off every 45 minutes, get off your ass, do two or 3 minutes of mobility work, some little strength exercises, and then if you're going to have to sit down, go and sit down, or just change positions, you know, spend 45 minutes standing up at a desk, spend 45 minutes lying on the floor, spend half an hour sitting cross-legged, you know, spend half an hour doing some tasks, because I know that they've done research on certain tasks are better standing and certain tasks that require thinking are better sitting. But that doesn't mean you can't keep moving. And I think that's the thing, is just not to get locked into one position for several hours, because that's not good.
Yeah, I do a lot of CPD work with osteopaths, and so teaching them to be able to video their patients moving dynamically and stuff. And, you know, they would say to me, well, there's no such thing as bad posture. You just don't want to be in any particular posture for more than 20 minutes. So, yeah, I guess actually you just keep moving around. But I think if you're stood, then you do that, because nobody stands. You're in front of me now. You have been for an hour and a half and you haven't been in the same position for more than 90 seconds. We're constantly shifting our weight and moving. That's just what we do. So I think if you sit, your 2 hours can pass. But you are right. I mean, if I'm writing, or if I'm doing some magazine stuff, then I can do that standing because I'm creating. If I had to really sit and look at some data or do something where I had to really think about it, I do have to sit. I definitely do. I don't know what it is, but I have to sit and concentrate. It's a saying for me. I have to do that. Yeah.
Right. Well, Shane, it's been fantastic. We could have gone on for that 5 hours you mentioned, but I know neither of us have that time. So maybe we'll resume in a few months, maybe when you've got your new book out. Talking of the existing book, Lost Art of Running.
Yep.
We'll make a link to that. And your website is called Running Reborn. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Running Reborn. So that kind of follows my journey. It's the coaching side, and you can find all the details on the book and everything. And any new work that I do will now drop onto that coaching site. I am writing more books, but they take a little bit of time to come out. This way, you can keep up with the work in a much quicker way. So yeah.
Okay, and we'll put all the other social media links and everything else onto the show notes as well. So thanks for being here. It's been brilliant. Really, really enjoyed that conversation. And I'm going to get outside now with a video and record my running.
I think I'll go to sleep.
Okay, Shane, take care. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you to Shane for joining me on the High Performance Human podcast. You can find links to everything we chatted about in the show notes below. Also, a reminder that if you are interested in being part of my SWAT Inner Circle, you can enjoy a 30-day trial period for just £1. Please email beth@thetriathloncoach.com or look for the link in the show notes. Well, that's all for this week. We'll be back in 7 days' time with another great guest. But for now, stay healthy and stay focused on being a high-performance human in every aspect of your life.